Hello, you're listening to Fresh Wellness with Lisa Shebeck, and welcome to my podcast. A homeopath by trade, with the aim of helping you discover health, natural living, and alternative therapies to bring you down the rabbit hole. In this episode of Fresh Wellness with Lisa Shebeck, I'm absolutely thrilled to have a question and answer session with the internationally acclaimed homeopath and lecturer, Hilary Dorian, who has over 40 years' experience as a homeopath, Chinese herbalist and acupuncturist. Hilary is a regular lecturer for many homeopathic colleges in the UK and abroad, and is frequently asked to speak at events on homeopathy. She currently runs a busy practice in Lingfield, Surrey, where she sees upwards of 50 patients a week. I'm very grateful to Hilary on a personal level for agreeing to do this podcast and for being my amazing mentor and supervisor. Thank you very much, Hilary.
Thank you so much for doing this. It's really funny because when I posted this on Instagram, my like Instagram followers shot up. Just and you're not
oh, even really? On Instagram. Glad to be of service.
So it's great. So I've got loads of questions from all different people, and I've kind of bunched them into sort of questions about you, and then there were some questions on homeopathic philosophy and then practice building. But I thought if it's okay to sort of go in straight to questions about you. Yeah. Okay, thank you so much. So the first one was, how did you get into homeopathy?
Okay, well, it's a long time ago now. 40 years ago, I studied acupuncture, and I qualified as an acupuncturist in 1982. I started my practice and I enjoyed it, but it always felt like there was something missing. I couldn't treat children for a start. They don't like needles, and pressure just doesn't quite do it in the same way. It helps, but and it's harder to treat acute things, and so I decided I needed something to supplement my practice, which was the idea of studying homeopathy just to treat some of the acute things that I saw or to help children. But as I got into homeopathy, I kind of fell in love with it, and my acupuncture practice went by the wayside after a number of years, and now my practice is pretty much 100% homeopathy. And so that, you know, that was it really. It's just I was very young when I got into alternative medicine. I had been to see a lecture on acupuncture, which kind of was a bit of a light bulb moment for me of something that I was really interested in that I might study. But yeah. Back then, there was very few places to study. And if I said to people, I'm studying acupuncture, they'd say, agriculture. No, no, acupuncture. Oh, aqualungs. No, no, acupuncture. And back then, people really hadn't heard of it. It was quite unusual. Now everybody's heard of it. Whether they've tried it or not, they have at least heard of it. Yeah. So it was a bit unusual in those days. I think gradually over the years, it got just more and more well known. And but yeah, homeopathy was it for me. When I discovered homeopathy, I never looked back.
As it is for many, I think, of people when they find it. Absolutely. Yeah. So where and who did you train with?
I trained at the College of Homeopathy. I think it would have been about the 1984 intake. The College of Homeopathy then was run by Barbara Harwood. Of course, the marvellous Robert Davidson, who made a big impression on me over the years. And I studied there for 4 years. And then after I qualified, as I say, my idea was to do both therapies, but I ended up just doing the homeopathy, really. I did in my second year, which would have been 1995, the winter of 1995 to 1996. I also went to study in Calcutta with Dr. Banerjee for two months. Wow. Yeah. And that was a real eye-opener in how homeopathy could be used, with Carol Boyce and Francis Treuherz. Yeah. It was a great experience, and that was where I studied back then in COH.
So I'm going to ask you a question that wasn't on my list, but just with how different is it in India that their way of prescribing? You know, I've heard it's very different, but I haven't obviously witnessed it for myself.
It's a bit less classical out of necessity. It's, you know, the clinics are often, it depends on what homeopaths you see. There are still obviously homeopaths like Sankaran who see patients individually and who take really in-depth cases. Mm. A lot of the people that we were taught by were jobbing homeopaths, really, who were seeing maybe 300 people in a day. Their waiting room would be absolutely full. Nobody had an appointment. They just turned up and they waited their turn and got their way down through the queue. And it was in an open room. The homeopath was at the front of the room talking to the person. Everybody else could hear them. So there was no privacy very often.
Everything,
you know, if you
were
talking about your hemorrhoids, 300 other people were party to that. And it was a lot of keynote prescribing. But my God, does it hone up your keynotes and your knowledge of some smaller remedies. That's not to say there was no classical prescribing going on or deeper cases taken. We saw some amazing cases as well. So it was a really rounded kind of education there and just so, so interesting. I absolutely loved my time in India. And I think I at a very impressionable age and time in my learning, I really did learn a lot from it.
Yeah, amazing. It sounds like something I'd love to do if we're able to obviously travel. I'd love to do that at some point.
Yeah, really, it was brilliant.
So what, you've obviously got such a strong but huge successful practice. It'd be great to know, one person asked, you know, tips for how you achieve that, really, for people starting out and sort of
Well, you forward. Know, the thing is, I think that you probably have to remember is that I have been in practice, first as an acupuncturist and now as a homeopath, for just on nearly 40 years now. So I've been doing it a long time, and that helps. You know, people are asking this question sometimes. They've only been qualified a year or two. And if I look back to where I was after a year or two of qualifying, I had maybe, and also bear in mind that I was an acupuncturist then. So as an acupuncturist, you see people every week. So it's much easier to build up a head of steam, as it were, in terms of making a living from it. But it took me quite a long time to become as busy as I am now. So don't compare, because it's a process, you know, it's a process that you have to develop a presence on that homeopathic platform, and it does take time. What I guess I had at the time was time. I didn't have to have another job. I was working above a health food shop, and the people in the health food shop were lovely, and they would always try and get me some patients. Somebody would come in and say, "What have you got for sleep?" And they'd call me down to have a chat. And once I'd had a chat, the person would sometimes book in with me. So I was earning enough fairly quickly because I didn't have big overheads then. I was only in my early 20s and I just had a small flat. So it was quite easy for me in that respect. And it isn't so easy for people who have to also run full-time jobs or kids around what they're doing, which is often the case, because it isn't the sort of thing that people go straight into after school. I was a bit unusual in that respect. It's pretty much what I did. But for most people, they have to juggle another life or two lives. And so it's naturally going to be a little bit slower. And what I was able to do then was to devote my time so that I could write articles for local newspapers. I could introduce myself. I had time. So one of my tips would be, if you have even one day set aside for homeopathy out of your busy week where you have to work other jobs or look after children, even if it's just 9 till 3 on a Monday, do homeopathy that day, even if you haven't got patients. Write letters to other practitioners introducing yourself, introduce yourself to the doctor's surgeries, maybe make up some leaflets, take it around to anywhere people sit, like hairdressers, well, not at the moment perhaps, but in general. A lot of local newspapers are really keen to have something interesting. You could say, I'm quite happy to write 4 free articles for you on seasonal things you can do with homeopathy. So in spring, you're going to do a little article on homeopathy and hay fever and how people can help themselves. In the autumn, you're going to write an article about colds and flus and so on. In the summer, it might be insect bites or sunburn. Papers are often really, really grateful to have something a bit more interesting between all the advertising. So do homeopathy on that day. You have to put the energy out to get it back. Mm. That would be my first bit of advice. Secondly, when you do have patients, almost being a good homeopath is secondary to being able to really listen to the patient and make them feel that they've been heard and give them confidence that you are able to help them. The first consultation often starts the healing process because you're playing back to people their life story and where their wounds are. And there's sometimes wounds that they didn't realize were still open or that were still giving them the pain that they have today. And the realization of that sometimes helps them to start to stop that process of going always back to the same wound. So I think, you know, if you're not really confident yet as a homeopath, be confident that as somebody who is really interested in getting this person well and really interested in hearing their story in as full a detail as you can. And nobody can get that whole story in the first consultation. It's a gradual unwinding process. And if you can keep them coming back, you'll get them better. Those would probably be the only tips that I've really got. But it will happen. Stick in there and it will happen. Don't lose heart. Surround yourself with positive people and other homeopaths who are, you know, all going through the same thing and all slowly climbing their way up to a place where they can say, you know what, I think it's time to make the leap. I don't need the full-time job anymore. I can make this leap and become a full-time homeopath.
Oh, that's lovely advice. Yeah, completely. I love it. Thank you. One of the other questions I've had is, you obviously take a lot of cases and have a very busy practice. How do you manage to do that without feeling drained? You know, a lot of us in our sort of early years of practicing find that even, you know, after just seeing a few patients can be quite draining in the early stages. So how do you manage that?
I don't really know. You know, it may be something just about my own character, but I have always had very, very busy days. And I sometimes have students sitting with me who go, oh my God, how'd you do it? I'm knackered by 3 o'clock and you're going on till sort of 7 in the evening. And I think, to me, it's a bit like chatting with a friend. That's not going to tire me out, mm-hmm. you know. And it's like I might have chatted with 16 friends that day. And the process for me of working out the remedies going on in the background, maybe that, I'm a great crossword, but you know, I love doing cryptic crosswords and puzzles. So and I do it to relax. And my husband often says he doesn't want to think anymore. He's so tired. For me, thinking is relaxing, and always has been. I love to sit down at the end of a day with a puzzle and a book, and a cryptic crossword. And you know, although my brain's been working all day, so it's maybe just the way my brain figures.
Yeah,
but obviously, as homeopaths, we sometimes hear some really, really quite traumatic stories and stories that are very upsetting and very affecting. And, you know, you can't help but be moved by people's stories. And so there are sometimes things that you carry about with you for a while until you've processed them. But by and large, at the end of the day, having listened to a lot of people's woes, all it makes me feel is lucky that I don't have those same woes that they have, that I'm going back to a nice household with a nice husband and a secure foundation in my life. So it makes me feel lucky, and it also makes me feel lucky that I have tools to help them, that I don't feel impotent in the face of their distress, that I've got something that I can do to help them. So I think those two things, one, that it's the way that my mind works. I like to have a busy mind. And secondly, that it makes me feel that I can do good in the world. And therefore, that sustains me, perhaps.
Yeah, and that's so important, isn't it? That gratitude, that feeling of gratitude and not taking it for granted, I think, which can be easy to do. So, yeah, no, completely. Thank you. So you've obviously got loads of cases where you've got successful cases, but I've been asked if, do you have a particularly memorable one that you can share with us, or where you see maybe the most dramatic improvement?
I think probably the ones that feel most dramatic are the ones that were maybe early on in one's career where you weren't sure how much of a difference you can make. Nowadays, I expect to make a difference. Back in the day, it's like, whoa, this stuff really works, kind of thing, you know. And so maybe some cases early on that I had that stand out more when you're looking back over what cases, you know, maybe in the last 5 years, cases all sort of run together. But
yeah.
I remember very early on, I was still working above the health food shop. I had a man who had very severe narcolepsy, and his life was a misery. He had narcolepsy since a serious head injury, and he obviously was falling asleep all day, couldn't sleep at night. When he did sleep, he had the most horrendous nightmares. And I remember one of them, he tells me that a common one would be that he'd be casting out a line to fish, and it would pull his eye out. The hook would catch his eye and he'd pull his own eye out. And they were just horrible, horrible dreams. He was on lots of amphetamines and they were affecting his heart, and he was really thin and his life was really miserable. Mm. And I was a young homeopath with no experience of treating anything as serious as this and not really much idea where to start. But it started with a head injury, which was a really serious head injury. He'd had a number of serious accidents. I didn't really know much about sifalinum in those days, but what I did know about, obviously, was arnica. And I gave him arnica 1N, and it made an absolutely massive difference to him, a huge difference. And then we kept on with arnica, went up to arnica 10M in the end, until he came off his medication. You know, it was just funny to me because this man was so, so miserable and had such a life. And a simple remedy like arnica, which was a positive factor, could do so much. So that probably is a standout case for me.
I love it. It gives me chills and like good old arnica, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, something that we might slightly dismiss as, oh, you banged your finger. But actually, sometimes when we, obviously looking at his case, there were other things that pertained to arnica, not just the history of his accident. He often felt bruised all over because of lack of sleep. He also felt that the bed wasn't comfortable. So there were other things other than the initial head injury, but nonetheless, it is essentially what was being addressed. So yeah, that was a good one.
I love it. And that whole, what you said about, you know, the wow factor of homeopathy, does it ever like lose its magic? Like I can't
imagine it ever. Because it seems so sort of effortless and natural, and you know, we're not giving harsh chemicals, we're not giving £1 million drugs, we're giving little sugar pellets coated with something that's essentially fairly natural and diluted, and we're working with energy, which is hard to get a grip of. And so there still is an amazement. It works quite as well as it does.
Yeah.
And I don't think you ever quite get over that. Although, yeah, it does definitely lessen. As I say, there's more of an expectation now. But yeah, it's still wonderful.
Yeah, lovely. How do you, one question I had was, how do you know so much about so many conditions, health conditions? You know, did you learn that all along the way while practicing? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a real interest in medicine and medical matters. And if somebody comes to me with a problem, I'm going to research it. I'm going to look up why it happens. What does that mean for the body? What drugs are used? What side effects do drugs have? And once you've looked up a condition several times, then it's in there and you don't need to keep looking it up. So I have a very good medical knowledge built up over all of these years of having a very busy practice. And there are not that many diseases that I haven't seen or don't know about. There might be a few, but, you know, it's over the years, I have built up a lot of knowledge about orthodox health matters.
You've got an amazing memory as well, haven't you? when you
I
do.
I have. I'm blessed with a good memory. I don't know where that comes from. All my family have that. My grandfather on my father's side used to recite poetry to us all the time as kids, just off the top of his head, long verses. And I think it must come from that side of the family, because my sister has it and I have it. We're blessed with a retentive memory.
Well, that's brilliant and very handy, obviously, for retaining remedy knowledge, isn't it? So, so just to move sort of a bit to homeopathic philosophy, someone's asked, you know, could you explain in your words the concept of susceptibility?
Okay, well, I guess if my in homeopathy, I would say my expertise is knowledge of materia medica, not philosophy, but susceptibility, in my way of thinking, is really a tendency to react, an ability to react to both internal and external stimuli, so that we can react in an energetic way and reach some sort of health. To be susceptible to something is due to an inherent weakness in our constitutional. It might be through a miasmatic weakness. It might be due to a poor lifestyle. And homeopathy, if it's well chosen, can satisfy that susceptibility. And so it's identifying a weakness in a sense. And it's helping to allow the body to throw off that weakness by using the appropriate remedy. I think the idea of susceptibility in homeopathy is a really brilliant one, because it makes perfect sense of the idea that what happens in our body is not just due to an external influence like COVID virus, say, but is very much about our own susceptibility to that virus or to that getting soaking wet in a shower of rain and then getting a cold. Not everybody will. Some people could be drenched in a shower, freezing cold, come back, warm up, they'll be none the worse for it. Some people will go down with some horrific fever. That's due to our susceptibility. And therefore, it helps us to understand that it isn't just what we would have called the morbific influence. It isn't just that external influence. It's a lot about ourselves as well. And therefore, that susceptibility is what we're aiming at with our remedies. That's my way of looking at it. Somebody like Ralph would be a better person to answer a philosophical question.
I'll get him on that. And I think you've actually answered sort of one of the next questions, which was someone asked about germ theory and do we recognise contagion? And like from what you've said, and my understanding is it's more about your, of course, germs are there, but it's more about susceptibility.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a few articles recently, not articles, but people talking recently about viruses aren't contagious, they're just on a body detox thing. And I have to say that's not something I quite agree with, because do I detox just because I sat on the plane next to somebody who's detoxing? You know, there definitely is a contagion. We see epidemics of diseases, we see households all, and it can't just be because they're all decided to detox at the same time. So yes, for me, clearly, the germ theory is real, but it's only part of the story. You know, the germ theory is gives too much weight to the germ. Because if the germ theory was 100% right, everybody who came in contact with that pathogen would succumb. And clearly they don't. A certain amount of people do, and a lot of people don't. And again, that comes down to susceptibility.
Yeah, and then someone else has asked the question about, is there any difference between terrain model and homeopathy, which I think you've explained the susceptibility point.
I would say the only difference there might be that the terrain model, which is that kind of thing, you know, I've forgotten who it was, something is right, the germ is nothing, the terrain is everything. I would say that they're both right. And they both come at it from different sides and have in their lifetime not agreed with each other. And then a moment of enlightenment a bit too late. But what I would say is that the terrain, which is, if you like, the soil that grows the bugs, we can influence it with homeopathy. And that is, I guess, how we satisfy the susceptibility. I guess in terrain theory, it isn't just about using homeopathy. You might be feeding the microbiome. You might be taking a supplement. You might be juicing in the mornings. You might be running in the afternoons. So I guess the terrain theory encompasses a lot of natural ways to improve your health and decrease your susceptibility to disease. So yeah, the old type susceptibility is kind of quite a nice way of honouring both of those things, you know, of saying yes, the germ theory is there, the terrain theory is also there, and we tie it all up together with this idea that we need to meet the susceptibility with the appropriate energetic response in the form of a remedy.
Yeah, you're completely right. Homeopathy does tie it together nicely, doesn't it? I don't know if that many other alternative or complementary therapies do it to quite the same degree.
If we didn't have any belief in a germ theory, then I don't suppose we would ever use nosodes. You know, we use nosodes because we identify that these germs, if we call them germs, these pathogens can adversely affect the body, and they can adversely affect the body long term. So I think if we didn't have any truck with the contagion theory, we wouldn't have nosodes of measles, for instance. We wouldn't have morbillinum or varicillinum.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I was going to ask, do you have a favourite remedy? I'm sure they have lots, but is there one?
I often say my favourite remedy is Rustox, but it would be hard to really have a truly have a favourite remedy. I have many favourite remedies because every remedy, when it's appropriate, can do the magic that we want homeopathy to do. So I guess the remedies that are favourites are remedies that you really get, that you really understand at a very deep level, and that's why they become favourites. Not because they necessarily can do more than another remedy, but just that you really get them. So I have a few remedies that I'm very fond of, but all remedies are brilliant.
What do you love about Rustox so much?
It's such a wide-ranging remedy. It has a very deep emotional picture that isn't always brought out in lectures where we learn more about its tendency for sprains and strains. But it has a big anxious and depressed picture going on in the background for certain people, often history of alcoholism in the family. So it has a big emotional aspect. It has a very physical aspect in that our overextension of ourselves, whether it's singing too much and helping our voice, whether it's running too much and seizing up our limbs and becoming stiff. Also, it's a fantastic remedy for all sorts of bacterial problems. Going back to when I was in India, we were working in a rural clinic, and people often came with dysentery. And the simple question was, stick your tongue out. If you had a red tongue tip, they got Rustox. If you didn't, they got China. And that was it. On to the next person. So I learned then how useful it was in things like dysentery, and they say, you know, aborts an infection near the rectum, so it can be useful for all of those types of things. It's useful for streptococcal and staphylococcal infections like impetigo, and then it's useful for lots of viruses. You use it for cold sores, you use it for chickenpox and shingles. It's got such a wide aspect to it that it has to be one of my favourite remedies.
Yeah, I think I'm going to do some more reading up actually on that now. You've inspired me for that, so thank you. Okay, so someone's asked, if you don't mind sharing, what is your, like, do you have a constitutional remedy? What is it? What would you say is your sort of go-to remedy?
You know, I don't really like the idea of the have to find a constitutional remedy. My way of thinking about it To answer that question, honestly, the remedy that has always worked for me through the years is Medidurinum. It's a big remedy for me, always has been. But is it my constitutional remedy? I'm not so sure about that. For me, a constitutional remedy just means it's the similimum at the moment, and that it will fit some of my mental, some of my general, and some of my physical symptoms. So maybe I have a bereavement and I move into an Ignatius state. I start having some Ignatius physical things, you know, sharp headaches in a single spot, chewing the inside of my cheeks, insomnia. I'll probably also have some general things. In other words, somebody who sees me at that point will give me Ignatius, and it will move me on, and it will show whatever is underneath. And if what is underneath is kind of pathological, we'll be able to see clearly another remedy.
Yeah.
If what isn't underneath is, if it isn't pathological, whatever's underneath, it takes a bit of digging to find out. You're looking back at somebody's history, their life going back very early. I have this feeling that we all have roots of numerous remedies.
Yeah.
I don't know how many. Maybe a typical person might have 10 remedies that they move in and out of. Ignatia, as I mentioned, that's also been a very big remedy through my life. It often helps me when I'm feeling low or upset or overwhelmed. It's a remedy that hits the spot for me. Medirinum is another one that has often helped me. And Lycopodium is another one that has often helped me. So I think there are roots that we, depending on our circumstances, will inflame, and we'll then see that again. I've definitely moved in and out of these states through my life.
That makes sense to me as well. And I love, like, in your lectures, you always had such a lovely way of simplifying it. I remember when people would say, what do you think about the layers theory? And you're like, well, that wasn't there when I trained. And actually,
yeah, I mean, the layers theory is a way in. And if it makes sense to you and it helps you to understand it, then I have no criticism of it. But when I was at college, Asiaga hadn't come up with that then. And for me, I do believe in keeping homeopathy simple, and it's finding the similimum. And the similimum, sometimes when I'm supervising cases, I find people have picked either too many rubrics or too many mentals, not enough generals, and it doesn't have a good enough overview. I think if you have 3 to 4 good mental symptoms, if you have 3 physicals and 3 generals, you're going to get a nice totality of the case. You can add a few more in depending on any strange, rare, and peculiar, which are always a great one. But essentially, I'm always looking for the current similimum. It can be put for me.
And what you said about the roots, I love that, makes sense from my personal experience. I find that there's always, like, there's 3 to 4 remedies that I go in and out of, Medirinum and Ignatia being 2, and then I quite often go to Pulsatilla, occasionally Sepia, and sometimes Napmure, and I find, depending on what mood I'm in, they're the ones I go in and out of.
Sense to me also from the idea that our roots are our epigenetics. We have roots because of what our parents went through and our grandparents went through. Remedy pictures don't come out of nowhere. I learned this with Kali Bramatum in the patient very vividly. Kali Bramatum has one of the rubrics is the child delusion of child falls overboard in their sight and they feel guilty. So it's a big remedy for OCD, and I gave it to a child for mild OCD, where she had a feeling that she might hurt people emotionally or physically by accident. And when I explained to the mother what I was giving, and when I mentioned this idea, because mum was a homeopath, that the child falling overboard in their sight, so they could do nothing, she said, "Oh my goodness," she said, "during the war, I don't know where they were. I think in Bulgaria or Czechoslovakia. I'm sorry, it escaped me. But wherever they were, the army came to their door. The grandmother of the child that I was treating, was told, hide under the bed, hide under the bed. And the father opened the door and shot dead on the doorstep by the soldiers. She watched from under the bed. And it just seemed like such a connection through three generations.
Yeah.
And this would have been a root. And the root would have been excited by something in the child's own life.
Yeah.
But had the root not been there, the situation the child was in might not have led to Caleb Bramatum.
Yeah.
So the roots, I think, that we all have are epigenetic roots that can be excited in our life depending on what happens to us or not.
Yeah. And that's amazing that homeopathy can help address that. You know, what else?
So amazing. One of the things I say about homeopathy, one of the reasons why I love it so much more than something like acupuncture, is that because we are working on such a profound level and changing people on a very profound level, we're reaching back into the past to injuries from generations ago. I believe we're helping to release karma, if that's not too airy-fairy for some of you.
No, I love that.
So we're reaching into the past. Mm. And as we lower my automatic influences, we're also changing somebody's health going forward and maybe making their life path really different. So homeopathy has the power to reach into the past and into the future. And I don't know any other medicine that really has that capability.
Completely. Are you ever going to write a book, Hilary, to share all this wisdom?
Do you know, I actually doubt it now.
Oh, no.
I used to always say I would. And I used to always say I will when God puts another day in the week. And now that I'm moving towards retirement, I might. But I find that the spoken word is something that suits me. Mm-hmm. And I plan to just keep on lecturing and doing webinars and seminars and using that sort of medium rather than writing. But I wouldn't rule it out entirely.
Well, fingers crossed. I've got one last question for you. Cheeky question. You probably guess who asked this. What's it like to have such a bloody marvellous daughter following in your footsteps?
Actually, it's great to have such a bloody marvellous daughter. I've got two bloody marvellous daughters, two bloody marvellous stepsons. But yeah, it's actually nice to have my daughter do follow my steps in homeopathy, not from a kind of egotistical point of view. It wouldn't have mattered to me whether anybody had been interested in homeopathy or not. My desire for my children is that they be happy and fulfilled. But it is nice to see your work being carried on, that your ideas that we've discussed at length are really, it's a direct legacy.
Yeah.
You like to leave a legacy with spreading knowledge, but it's a more direct legacy. But more importantly, it gives us another sort of connection where we can use the homeopathic shorthand. If I say, oh, she was a bit of a platina, immediately what I mean, I don't have to go through whole sentence or paragraph on the attributes of this person. I can just say that. So it gives us a kind of shorthand connection for certain things, which is lovely.
Yeah.
But, you know, all my kids are brilliant, and Emily equally so. And I'm really glad that she's found homeopathy, because I just think it's such a brilliant career. And it's a career that I managed to fit around having children. You know, when I was first having my children, I was able to, my friend Teresa, who became my receptionist for 22 years, she said, I'll come and help you while you're working. And she came to my house and looked after them both when they were babies while I was seeing patients. And my patients were great. They'd let me, I'd say, I've just got to go and feed Luckily, breastfeeding was easy, 10 minutes in and out. And they would, if it was important, they would wait, or they wouldn't mind if I brought the baby in and breastfed as we chatted. Yeah. It's a job that fits very easily around children. And I found that to be very useful. So that hopefully will be useful for Emily too when she decides to have children.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, it's lovely. Thank you so much, Hilary. I really, really appreciate your time. And I know there's loads of people that are looking forward to listening to this. Your knowledge is...
Very grateful for them being there and wanting to listen to what I have to say.
Thank you so much.